Chapter 6. It was waiting for them in the center of the long table in the conference room. A small crowd of people had gathered around it. The halogen spots in the ceiling lit it perfectly. There was a brown 9x12 envelope with a metal closure and a torn flap, and a single sheet of white letter-sized paper. On it were printed 10 words. "The day upon which Armstrong will die is fast approaching." The message was split into 2 lines, exactly centered between the margins and set slightly above the middle of the paper. There was nothing else visible. People stared at it in silence. The guy in the suit from the reception desk pushed backward through the crowd and spoke to Froelich. "I handled the envelope," he said. "I didn't touch the letter, just spilled it out."
"How did it arrive?" she asked.
"The garage guard took a bathroom break, came back and found it on the ledge inside his booth. He brought it straight up to me. So I guess his prints are on the envelope, too."
"When exactly?"
"Half hour ago." "How does the garage guard work his brakes?" Reacher asked. The room went quiet. People turned toward the new voice. The desk guy started in with a fierce, "Who the hell are you?" look. But then he saw Froelich's face and shrugged and answered obediently. "He locks the barrier down," he said. "That's how. Runs to the bathroom, runs back. Maybe 2 or 3 times a shift. He's down there 8 hours at a stretch."
Froelich nodded. "Nobody's blaming him. Anybody call a forensic team yet?"
"We waited for you."
"Okay, leave it on the table. Nobody touch it and seal this room tight."
"Is there a camera in the garage?" Reacher asked.
"Yes, there is."
"So get Nendick to bring us tonight's tape, right now."
Nagley craned over the table.
"Rather florid wording, don't you think? And fast definitely takes the prediction defense away, I would say. Turns the whole thing into an overt threat."
Froelich nodded.
"You got that right," she said slowly. "If this is somebody's idea of a game or a joke, it just turned very serious very suddenly."
She said it loud and clear, and Reacher caught her purpose fast enough to watch the faces in the room. There was absolutely no reaction on any of them. Froelich checked her watch.
"Armstrong's in the air," she said, "on his way home to Georgetown."
Then she was quiet for a beat.
"Call out an extra team," she said, "half to Andrews, half to Armstrong's house, and put an extra vehicle in the convoy, and take an indirect route back."
There was a split second of hesitation, and then people started moving with the practiced efficiency of an elite team readying itself for action. Reacher watched them carefully, and he liked what he saw. Then he and Nagley followed Froelich back to her office. She called an FBI number and asked for a forensic team, urgent, listened to the reply, and hung up.
"Not that there's much doubt about what they'll find," she said to nobody in particular.
Then Nendick knocked and came in, carrying 2 videotapes.
2 cameras, he said. "One is inside the booth, high up, looking down and sideways, supposed to ID individual drivers in their cars. The other is outside, looking straight up the alley, supposed to pick up approaching vehicles."
He put both cassettes on the desk and went back out. Froelich picked up the first tape and scooted her chair over to her television set, put the tape in and pressed play. It was the sideways view from inside the booth. The angle was high, but it was about right to catch a driver framed in a car window. She wound back 35 minutes, pressed play again. The guard was shown sitting on his stool with the back of his left shoulder in the shot, doing nothing. She fast wound forward until he stood up. He touched a couple of buttons and disappeared. Nothing happened for 30 seconds. Then an arm snaked into view from the extreme right edge of the picture, just an arm in a heavy, soft sleeve. A tweed overcoat, maybe. The hand on the end of it was gloved in leather. There was an envelope in the hand. It was pushed through the half-closed sliding window and dropped onto the ledge. Then the arm disappeared.
"He knew about the camera," Froelich said. "Clearly," Nagley said. "He was a yard shy of the booth, stretching out."
"But did he know about the other camera?" Reacher asked.
Froelich ejected the first tape and inserted the second. Wound backward 35 minutes, pressed play. The view was straight up the alley. The quality was poor.
There were pools of light from outdoor spotlights, and the contrast with areas of darkness was vivid. The shadows lacked detail. The angle was high and tight. The top of the picture cut off well before the street end of the alley. The bottom of the shot stopped maybe 6 feet in front of the booth. But the width was good. Very good. Both walls of the alley were clearly in view. There was no way of approaching the garage entrance without passing through the camera's field of vision. The tape ran. Nothing happened. They watched the time code counter until it reached a point 20 seconds before the arm had appeared. Then they watched the screen. A figure appeared at the top. Definitely male, no doubt about it. There was no mistaking the shoulders or the walk. He was wearing a heavy tweed overcoat, maybe gray or dark brown. Dark pants, heavy shoes, a muffler around his neck, and a hat on his head. A wide-brimmed hat, dark in color, tilted way down in front. He walked with his chin tucked down. The video picked up a perfect view of the crown of his hat, all the way down the alley.
"He knew about the second camera," Reacher said.
The tape ran on. The guy walked fast, but purposefully, not hurrying, not running, not out of control. He had the envelope in his right hand, holding it flat against his body. He disappeared out of the bottom of the shot and reappeared 3 seconds later, without the envelope. He walked at the same purposeful pace all the way back up the alley and out of shot at the top of the screen. Froelich froze the tape.
"Description?" "Impossible," Nagley said.
"Male, a little short and squat, right-handed probably, no visible limp. Apart from that, we don't know diddly. We saw nothing."
"Maybe not too squat," Reacher said. "The angle foreshortens things a little."
"He had inside knowledge," Froelich said. "He knew about the cameras and the bathroom breaks. So he's one of us."
"Not necessarily," Reacher said. "He could be an outsider who staked you out. The exterior camera must be visible if you're looking for it, and he could assume the interior camera. Most places have them. And a couple of nights' surveillance would teach him the bathroom break procedure. But you know what? Insider or outsider, we drove right past him. We must have, when we went out to see the cleaners, because even if he's an insider, he needed to time the bathroom break exactly right, so he needed to be watching. He must have been across the street for a couple of hours looking down the alley, maybe with binoculars."
The office went quiet.
"I didn't see anybody," Froelich said.
"Me neither," Nagley said.
"I had my eyes closed," Reacher said.
"We wouldn't have seen him," Froelich said. "He hears a vehicle coming up the ramp, he ducks out of sight, surely."
"I guess so," Reacher said. "But we were real close to him, temporarily."
"Shit," Froelich said. "Yeah, shit," Nagley echoed.
"So what do we do?"
Froelich asked.
"Nothing," Reacher said. "Nothing we can do. This was more than 40 minutes ago. If he's an insider, he's back home by now, maybe tucked up in bed. If he's an outsider, he's already on I-95 or something, west or north or south, maybe 30 miles away. We can't call the troopers in 4 states and ask them to look for a right-handed man in a car who doesn't limp. No better description than that."
"They could look for an overcoat and a hat on the back seat or in the trunk."
"It's November, Froelich. Everybody's got a hat and a coat with them."
"So what do we do?"
she asked again.
"Hope for the best. Plan for the worst. Concentrate on Armstrong, just in case this whole thing is for real. Keep him wrapped up tight. Like Stuyvesant said, threatening isn't necessarily the same thing as succeeding."
"What's his schedule?"
Nagley asked.
"Home tonight, the hill tomorrow," Froelich said.
"She'll be okay. You scored perfect around the Capitol. If Reacher and I couldn't get to him there, no squat guy in an overcoat is going to. Assuming a squat guy in an overcoat wants to, instead of just shaking you up for the fun of it."
"You think?"
"Like Stuyvesant said, take a deep breath and tough it out. Be confident."
"Doesn't feel good. I need to know who this guy is."
"We'll find out who he is, sooner or later. Until then, if you can't attack at one end, you have to defend at the other."
"She's right," Reacher said. "Concentrate on Armstrong, just in case."
Froelich nodded vaguely and took the tape out of the machine and put the first one back in, restarted it, and stared at the screen until the garage guard came back from his bathroom break and noticed the envelope and picked it up and hurried out of shot with it.
"Doesn't feel good," she said again.
An FBI forensic crew came by an hour later and photographed the sheet of paper on the conference room table. They used an office ruler for a scale reference and then used a pair of sterile plastic tweezers to lift the paper and the envelope into separate evidence bags. Froelich signed a form to keep the chain of evidence intact, and they took both items away for examination. Then she got on the phone for 20 minutes and tracked Armstrong all the way out of the Marine helicopter at Andrews and all the way home.
"Okay, we're secure," she said. "For now."
Nagley yawned and stretched.
"Should take a break.
Be ready for a hard week."
"I feel stupid," Froelich said.
"I don't know if this is a game or for real."
"You feel too much,"
Nagley said. Froelich looked at the ceiling.
"What would Joe do now?"
Reacher paused and smiled. "Go to the store and buy a suit, probably."
"No. Seriously."
"He'd close his eyes for a minute and work it all out like it was a chess puzzle. He read Karl Marx, you know that? He said Marx had this trick of explaining everything with one single question, which was, who benefits?"
"So?"
"Let's say it's an insider doing this. Karl Marx would say, okay, the insider plans to benefit from it. Joe would ask, okay, how does he plan to benefit from it?"
"By making me look bad in front of Stuyvesant?"
"And getting you demoted or fired or whatever, because that rewards him in some way. That would be his aim. But that would be his only aim. Situation like that, there's no serious threat against Armstrong. That's an important point. And then Joe would say, okay, suppose it's not an insider. Suppose it's an outsider. How does he plan to benefit?"
"By assassinating Armstrong."
"Which gratifies him in some other way. So Joe would say, what you've got to do is proceed as if it's an outsider, and proceed very calmly and without panicking, and above all, successfully. That's two birds with one stone. If you're calm, you deny the insider his benefit. If you're successful, you deny the outsider his benefit." Froelich nodded, frustrated.
"But which is it? What did the cleaners tell you?"
"Nothing," Reacher said. "My read is somebody they know persuaded them to smuggle it in, but they aren't admitting to anything."
"I'll tell Armstrong to stay home tomorrow."
Reacher shook his head. "You can't. You do that, you'll be seeing shadows every day, and he'll be in hiding for the next 4 years. Just stay calm and tough it out."
"Easy to say."
"Easy to do. Just take a deep breath." Froelich was still and silent for a spell. Then she nodded.
"Okay,"
she said.
"I'll get you a driver. Be back here at 9 in the morning. There'll be another strategy meeting, exactly a week after the last one."
The morning was damp and very cold, like nature wanted to be done with fall and get started with winter. Exhaust fumes drifted down the streets in low white clouds, and pedestrians hurried by on the sidewalks with their faces ducked deep into scarves. Nagley and Reacher met at 8:40 at the cab line outside the hotel and found the Secret Service town car waiting for them. It was double-parked with the engine running and the driver standing next to it. He was maybe 30 years old, dressed in a dark overcoat and gloves, and he was up on his toes, scanning the crowd anxiously. He was breathing hard, and his breath was pluming in the air.
"He looks worried," Nagley said.
The inside of the car was hot. The driver didn't speak once during the journey, didn't even say his name, just bulled through the morning traffic and squealed into the underground garage, led them at a fast walk into the interior lobby and into the elevator, up 3 floors and across to the reception desk. It was manned by a different guy. He pointed down the corridor toward the conference room.
"Started without you," he said. "You better hurry."
The conference room was empty, apart from Froelich and Stuyvesant sitting face to face across the width of the table. They were both still and silent, both pale. On the polished wood between them lay 2 photographs.
One was the official FBI crime scene 8x10 of the previous day's 10-word message. The day upon which Armstrong will die is fast approaching. The other was a hasty Polaroid of another sheet of paper. Reacher stepped close and bent to look.
Shit, he said.
The Polaroid showed a single sheet of letter-sized paper, exactly like the first three in every detail. It followed the same format, a printed message neatly centered near the middle of the page. 9 words. A demonstration of your vulnerability will be staged today.